In 1960, director Alfred Hitchcock gave the world another masterpiece with this psychological thriller.
In 2020, we continue our walk through the Jim Beam Small Batch collection.
The film is Psycho.
The whiskey is Booker's.
And we'll review them both. This is
the Film and Whiskey Podcast.
Welcome to the Film and Whiskey Podcast, where each week we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey. I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And this week, for your Halloween, we are looking at the 1960 horror film Psycho. Brad, I am pumped to get into this. You know, we had initially penciled in John Carpenter's movie Halloween for our Halloween episode. But then about a month ago, we were involved in a giveaway with Universal Studios where we were giving out digital copies of this film Psycho. And the more that I was just inundating myself with images and pictures from this movie, I was like, you know, let's just switch it up. Let's do Psycho this season. And I am so, so glad we did. It's been a few years since I've seen this movie. I know for you, Brad, this was your first time seeing the film. This is the third Hitchcock movie that we've done on the podcast. I think at least the third. And for me, like of all of Hitchcock's classics, this is the most unique. It's definitely like the biggest outlier. Hitchcock is known for being the master of suspense. And especially at this period of his career, he'd been making these big budget, you know, Technicolor pictures with Paramount. And he follows up something like North by Northwest, this kind of fun spy thriller, with this low budget black and white slasher film. It is a straight up horror movie. And I've always been interested in how effective this movie is, but also like how far out of the general realm Hitchcock was working in at the time.
Yeah, I mean, North by Northwest is like one of my favorite films from growing up. Like, you know, whenever I talk about watching movies with my dad, Cary Grant was a staple, and North by Northwest was like one of my favorite movies as a kid. So to think about that movie and then come into Psycho with, like you said, Bob, this is a slasher film, you know, before the censors really allowed filmmakers to do whatever they wanted. This was pushing the boundaries. It was pushing the envelope, pushing the limits. And it's a crazy movie, Bob.
It really is, man. And it's very bleak and it's very dark. And you get kind of this like icky feeling just watching it because, you know, we're going to get into this in our synopsis in Brad Explains, but like there really is no resolution to the whole thing. And it leaves you with a kind of sick feeling in your stomach. And I think that's the sign of a movie that is still effective 60 years later. And it has been 60 years since this movie came out. Brad, before we move into our favorite segment, Brad Explains, I want to stop right here and I want to say anyone who has not seen the movie Psycho, please go watch it before you continue listening to this episode. I know that we may all be familiar with a certain scene in the movie, even if we haven't actually watched the film before, but this is a movie that has multiple kind of twists to it. And unless you want to have the whole thing spoiled, which I don't recommend you doing, just hit pause, go watch the film, and then come back and engage with us in a little bit.
And I'll add to that, Bob. I am not a horror film person. I really despise a lot of slasher horror type movies. You know, Possession, things like that. It's just not my jam.
Sure.
Not a big fan of it. But even for me, I watch Psycho. And I would recommend anyone watching it, even if you don't normally like horror films. I think that this is a movie worth watching.
Yeah, completely agree. And I'm glad to hear that right up front, which means we should have a pretty productive conversation. But right now, it's time for Brad Explains. This is the part of the podcast where Brad breaks down the movie that he has just seen, often for the first time. And we have that case today. So, Brad, can you offer our listeners a spoiler-filled synopsis of the movie Psycho?
Oh boy, can I ever. So the movie Psycho centers around a young woman named Marion Crane and her boyfriend, Sam. They are meeting in hotels and having an affair of sorts. Neither of them are married. But you find out very early on that they want to get married, but Sam is still paying alimony to an ex-wife and he has debts and they just don't have the money to get married. And Marion heads on back to work, and she works at a real estate company. And one of their biggest clients offers to purchase this big piece of property, and he gives them $40,000 cash and says, you know, put it down for me. I want this property. Well, of course, Marion takes the money to the bank to deposit the cash, but instead she runs off with the money and plans on driving to California to run away with her boyfriend so they can be married. On the way there, she runs into a police officer who starts kind of questioning her story and why she's out there. She was sleeping overnight on the side of the road, and she gets nervous, and so she goes and buys a new car. And then later that night, she stops to stay at this place called the Bates Motel. While there, she meets the young innkeeper named Norman Bates, who tells her kind of a sad story about his mother becoming an invalid, that she's a little bit cracked, but that she stays up in the house and that, you know, he runs this hotel for people. And they have a really nice conversation and kind of go back and forth. And when she retires for the night, she goes to take a shower. And lo and behold, in the midst of her shower, a dark figure appears from behind the shower curtain, opens it, and stabs her to death. At this point, the movie becomes a murder investigation. A private investigator is hired by the owner of the $40,000. He makes his way around the motels in the area, finds his way to Bates Motel, and starts asking some, you know, questions about what's going on. And in the end, he wanders up to the main house and is murdered, seemingly by the mother. The mother stabs him, he falls down the stairs, and he also is buried in the swamp out behind the Bates Motel. At this point, he has called the sister and the boyfriend of our original main character. They go out to the Bates Motel to try and figure out what's going on. Sam distracts Norman while Marion's sister, Lila, heads on up to the house. And she tries to go downstairs, and she finds the corpse of the mother sitting in a chair. And Norman comes in behind her and tries to stab her while dressed as his mother. Luckily, Sam comes in, saves Lila, and you find out at the end of the movie that a court psychiatrist has worked with the now arrested Norman Bates. And you find out that he had been pretending to be his mother for the last 10 years, ever since he murdered his own mother and her boyfriend. And that was it.
Yeah, that's the end of the movie. It ends in a really weird, bleak, dramatic kind of fashion. And yeah. Brad, before we get any further, you know, I was thinking about saving this for the second part of our show where we get more into analysis, but I kind of have to ask now, you know, there's two big twists in the movie. The first is in that shower scene where Marion, the main character, is killed 45 minutes into the movie, and then the movie completely switches focus, completely switches point of view. But the second big twist is at the end of the film, where you find out that it has not been the mother killing these people all the time. Like, you thought that it was the mother, and that Anthony Perkins, as Norman Bates, has been cleaning up all of these murders as a dutiful son, and you find out at the end of the film, actually, no, he's a psychopath. Who murdered his own mom, assumed her identity, has been dressing up as her and killing young women for 10 years. And the reveal had to be so shocking to audiences in 1960. And we're going to get into some of the background around that. But the question I have for you, Brad, is does the ending of the movie work in 2020? What did you think of the end of the film?
I think that it's a dated twist. I think that it's been done many more times since then. And so pretty early on, as soon as I saw Norman, and I kind of knew what was going to happen. And Hitchcock doesn't necessarily hide it. Like, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when Marion and Norman are having their conversation in the evening. And you just get so many beautiful shots of Norman sitting there with the image of a giant falcon sitting right behind him, almost like this bird of prey. Mm. That is slowly reeling in Marion.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I've suggested it myself, but I hate to even think about it. She needs me. It's not as if she were a maniac, a raving thing. She just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes. Haven't you?
And so there's little things like that that I think point towards it. And so, like, between the cinematography and the little techniques that he does to foreshadow what's going to come, paired with, you know, 50, 60 years of knowing twists like this, I think that the twist at the end is fairly standard anymore.
Yeah.
But I would agree with you, Bob. When this came out in 1960, I'm sure that it was just an absolutely epic ending to the movie.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll get into a lot of this background, but this movie was really one of the first that examined quote-unquote serial killers. It was based off a book by this guy named Robert Bloch, and he was writing about the killer Ed Gein, who had, like Norman Bates, murdered his mom. This is a real-life story. Murdered his mom, made a room where he, like, enshrined her. Very, very creepy stuff. And so he wrote this fictional book called Psycho, and it was adapted into this screenplay, and Hitchcock jumped on board and could not find the funding for this movie because the studios were like, absolutely not. No one wants to come watch this cheap, you know, exploitative kind of schlock. We're not going to give you this money. And so he had a really small budget to work with comparatively from North by Northwest. And so he decided that instead of doing his usual thing, which is huge budget color film, he was going to take the crew from Alfred Hitchcock Presents, his TV show. And they were going to film this movie in black and white with basically a TV crew filming the movie. And I think that it actually was a brilliant decision, you know, not just financially, but like in terms of the aesthetics of the movie, because it looks so different from everything else Hitchcock does. You know, Brad, we watched Rear Window and Vertigo for this podcast, and Rear Window has a very claustrophobic, contained kind of environment. But you look at a movie like Vertigo with these huge, expansive shots of San Francisco, this movie is very clearly leaning into the kind of low budget, small, contained story that it has.
What I really love about that story, Bob, is the fact that you don't often get to see these legendary directors at the height of their powers choosing to limit themselves to a small budget and a small production crew. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, no, like normally by this point of a director of this caliber's career, they get whatever they want. They can have the largest budget. They can have all the actors they want. They can have the Jimmy Stewart. They can have the Cary Grant. And instead, we see Hitchcock saying, you know what? I just really want to make this movie, and so I'm going to do it with a TV crew and some actors that are relatively unknown, and we're going to make it work, and we're going to make a masterpiece of cinema. And so what really shines in this film is the cinematography, the sound direction. Just everything about this movie is technically done so well. And it almost shines even more when you know how little money they spent on it.
Yeah, completely agree. And yet, even at this kind of micro budget compared to his other movies, this has Hitchcock written all over it. Like, it may not be a suspense movie as much as a horror movie, but the themes that you constantly see Hitchcock exploring are still here. When we watched Rear Window, Brad, I think we talked about that there were two basic themes constantly running through Hitchcock films, and that is sex and voyeurism. And how in Rear Window, especially, that voyeuristic thing comes up again and again and again, where Hitchcock is putting you in the shoes of Jimmy Stewart and you're spying on people and you're doing this really weird, dirty thing by looking in on people's lives. And even as you're saying, like, this is gross, why are you doing this, Jimmy Stewart? Internally, you're like, but show me more. And I think Hitchcock is really good at bringing out those kind of deep, dark sides of ourselves. And he does it again in this movie. This movie pushed the boundaries of kind of sex on screen way farther than they'd ever been pushed before. I mean, you have the very opening scene. Janet Leigh is in a bra, and no one had ever been in a brassiere like that on American screens. It was like shocking to people. And it's like three different scenes that she's, you know, almost topless. When you get to the shower scene where she's killed, it is so carefully edited that at first they wouldn't let Hitchcock get this movie into theaters, and he had to walk the censor board frame by frame through that shower scene because they were all convinced they'd seen breasts. And he was like, no, you saw what you wanted to see. I didn't actually show any of that. And I just think it's like there's something psychological going on when you watch a Hitchcock movie, because even as you're engaging with it, even as you're entertained by it, I think he's kind of implicating you in whatever's happening on screen. And like, I keep going back to those two scenes with Norman Bates where he's spying on Janet Leigh through the wall. And you're like, oh, what a creepy guy. This doesn't feel right. And yet the camera shows his point of view. Like, we are watching Janet Leigh undress as the audience. And then after he kills her and he's trying to dispose of her body in the swamp, and the car is like kind of going down into the swamp, and then it stops. And the crazy thing about that scene is that we've just watched this person, or we think his mother, kill somebody. And now we're watching him clean up her murder. And yet when the car doesn't sink all the way, there's a suspenseful moment there because we're somehow on his side, thinking he might not get away with it. It's a very creepy position to be in as an audience member.
Bob, I'm sure a lot of people were there. I didn't want it to sink. I wanted to see him struggle because I did not want him to get away with this murder.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'm not saying that you want him to get away with it, but like, I think you'd agree that that scene is played for suspense.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think my favorite thing about Anthony Perkins' performance is the way he smiles in this movie. Mm. I mean, that moment where the car is like sinking and he kind of has this little quirky smile, and then it stops and you see him get a little nervous, and then it finally sinks down into the depths of the swamp, and you see just this like quirky one-sided smile pop up on his face, and you're just like, holy crap, bro, this dude's psycho.
This man is disturbed. Yeah, and even before that, when you're first introduced to Norman Bates, and you can tell that he's socially awkward, you can tell that he doesn't know how to react to this very beautiful woman in his presence, his performance is like so, so nuanced in a way that you didn't really see in acting styles in the late 1950s. Like, he stands out from everyone else in this movie. And I think Janet Leigh does a really great job as well. But watching Anthony Perkins' body language, watching the way that he stutters, watching the way that his eyes move, and you can sense his discomfort, like, I was really, truly blown away at how incredible of a performance he gave.
It was really impressive when the private detective, Arbogast, comes into the picture with him and starts asking him questions. And at first, you know, Bates starts off somewhat confident and, you know, he's just kind of having a conversation. But as he gets caught in little tiny lies, you know, like, oh, well, nobody's been here for a few weeks. And then a few seconds later, he's like, well, this couple about a week and a half ago was here. And
tell me all about her.
Well, she arrived rather late one night, and she went straight to sleep and left early the next morning.
Well, how early?
Oh, very early.
Mm-hmm. Which morning was that?
The next morning, Sunday.
I see.
And he starts getting caught in these lies. He starts stuttering more, and he gets nervous about it. And man, his performance, without Anthony Perkins in this movie, I just don't know if you have a masterpiece of, you know, thriller cinema.
No, I don't think you do. And I think, again, it's that combination of his performance and also Hitchcock kind of like very discreetly almost making him a sympathetic figure. Not that you sympathize with what he's doing, but by putting you in a position where you're watching him have to clean up a murder and then building suspense out of whether or not he'll get away with it, it pushed the boundaries so far as a film. Like, I can't think of another movie where you got to see the kind of things that you saw in this film. And I think that there are moments in movie history where a movie is so far ahead of what's being made at the time that it just kind of causes an explosion and everything after it starts to mimic it. And when Psycho first came out, like, people didn't quite know what to do with it. It was a huge, huge success. But critics didn't like it at first. The New York Times critic, Bosley Crowther, he actually panned this movie when it first came out, said it was melodramatic and over the top and schlocky. And then at the end of the year, he put it on his 10 best list because he went back and saw it again. And I think it's one of those movies that it hits the American cinemas like an atomic bomb, and people don't really know how to react. This was, I mean, like, Brad, I'm going to drop a really kind of pointless trivia fact about this movie, but like, this was the first movie where they showed a toilet in the bathroom. It was the first time ever that a toilet was flushed on screen. So, like, you can get a sense of how kind of puritanical American movies were up to this point. And Hitchcock's like, okay, cool, we'll put a toilet in here. Also, we're going to stab a woman to death and you're going to see blood all over the place. And Anthony Perkins is going to come in with a mop and you're going to see blood going back and forth and sloshing around. You're going to almost see people get naked. Like, it's crazy to think how far he pushed the envelope, given like the kind of movies he was making just a year or so before this.
And you have to wonder, was one of the reasons he was able to push the envelope simply due to the fact that he was Alfred Hitchcock? Mm. You know what I mean? Like, at this point, I would say he was pretty much a legendary director by now. He already had so many great films under his belt that was he able to use his considerable weight when, you know, a lesser director might not have been able to get the censor boards to even look at the film, let alone listen to him explain shot by shot why they were wrong and why they should let it be seen.
I think that's a really great point, Brad. And you were kind of talking earlier about how, you know, he not only brought his weight as a director into the project, but like you can see how well made it is on such a small budget. And I was really blown away at the cinematography in this movie because I remembered the fact about it being made by a TV crew. I was expecting all the setups to be really plain and simple, like watching an old 50s TV show. But no, the camera work in this movie is really, really intricate. And the camera is constantly moving and kind of like roving around rooms. It's almost like a character unto itself. And there's some really great push-ins. There's some great dolly movements throughout the movie. I think the most, like, the showiest shot, which is also one of the coolest shots in the movie, is that great shot of at the end of the shower scene where you see the blood going down the drain and it fades into Janet Leigh's eye. And the next shot is that it's a really slow pull back out of her eye, and then you see her dead body, and the camera moves into the other room and slowly tracks over to where that money is sitting on the nightstand. Like, it is a crazy shot. I'm still like, how did they pull this off? Because Janet Leigh, this poor woman, is having to hold her breath and try to hold her eye contact for like 30 seconds as this camera slowly pulls out. But Brad, like, I was truly, truly impressed with the cinematography in this movie.
Well, I think what it tells me about Hitchcock is that he must have been just a phenomenal communicator and leader on the set. You know, when he's working with people who are used to television style film, you know, television style cinematography, the ability to communicate his vision to them, to get the cameraman to capture exactly what he wanted, it just had to have been off the charts. And his ability to capture the vision that he wanted is really just impressive. And it's just crazy, Bob, like you said earlier, this movie just set forth so many tropes that to have done that with a television crew, and it's just so cool, man.
Well, and not only that, but like he was such a master at marketing too, especially like using his own image to market things. So if you ever get a chance, Brad, you should go watch the original trailer for this movie. It's like a 4-minute long like featurette, and it's played as like, oh, Alfred Hitchcock's going to give you a tour of his new movie, of the set of his new movie, Psycho. And Hitchcock's walking you around. But then every time he comes to a door, he's like, oh, you don't want to know what goes on in there. And he goes to the next thing. And so like he's slowly building this anticipation for the movie without giving anything away. And he knew he could not give away the fact that the star of the movie was going to get murdered halfway through. And so what he did, which was an unprecedented thing at the time, he had this huge marketing campaign where he convinced theaters that were showing this movie to not let anyone in after the movie had started, because it was common practice back then. You didn't have previews before the movie. Trailers came after the movie. And so they would just put the lights down and start the movie. And people were always coming in late. And sometimes people would wander in 30, 40 minutes after the movie had started just for something to do. And he knew that if people came in late, they were going to come in after Janet Leigh was murdered and ask, where's Janet Leigh? So they had this crazy marketing campaign that somehow people agreed to. And because they said, we won't let you in the theater after this movie started, you started to see lines around the block, like in every city in America. This movie was such a huge financial hit because he knew exactly how to play, you know, this kind of marketing game without giving away the twist of his own movie. It's really brilliant stuff.
I just love stories like that because I feel like marketing gimmicks happen nowadays, but never on that level. You know what I mean? And like, how many directors, I know that we have famous directors out there, but like, this would almost be like if Christopher Nolan sat down in like a fake spaceship and tried to explain time travel to us as like a promo for Interstellar.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like you just don't see stuff like this anymore. And it really does make me a little bit sad because stuff like that was just, it's just ridiculous.
Well, Brad, I think this is a really good place for us to stop and try our whiskey for the day. So what do you say we get into drinking this Booker's?
Let's get to it.
All right, so today we are trying Booker's Bourbon. This is actually batch number 2019-01, meaning it was bottled in January of 2019. This is known as Teresa's batch of Booker's. So if you are, you know, listening to the show and you know a lot about the Booker's brand, that's the batch number. If you haven't tried Booker's, like either one of us, incidentally, you don't really need to know all that information, but I'm just going to give a little bit of background here. Booker's is a brand made by the Jim Beam Corporation. It is named after Booker No, who is one of the most legendary figures in the history of bourbon making. He was the master distiller at Jim Beam for a long time. It's part of a line that Jim Beam makes called the Small Batch Collection, which is four brands: Baker's, Booker's, Basil Hayden's, and Knob Creek. So we are getting kind of the upper shelf stuff from the Jim Beam line today. Each batch of Booker's is labeled with year and month, so people kind of collect them and try different variations of them. This batch is called Teresa's Batch. It was named after Teresa Whittemer, who is a 30-year veteran of the Jim Beam Company. She worked very closely with Booker No, and they decided to honor her with this batch of whiskey. Brad, this bad boy is clocking in at 125.9 proof. It is 6 years, 3 months, and 1 day old. And the mash bill is 77% corn, 13 rye, and 10 malted barley. This was a sample sent to us by our Florida-based Instagram friends, Bourbon and Stuff. Thank you again for sending us so many samples. And Brad, let's get into talking about this one. We have a barrel-proof bourbon in our hands, my friend.
Yes, we do. And as I nose this beaut, you are just getting some amazing notes. There's a lot of nice, heavy oak. But you also get a lot of brown sugar, caramel, a little bit of vanilla. I mean, it's a heavy nose, and I really like it, and I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, Brad, this is just like your standard classic bourbon notes, but they're all amplified, you know, to 11, to reference our Spinal Tap episode here. The one thing that I'm not really getting on this is peanut butter. And Jim Beam is kind of famous for having a scent that people like to call Beam Nut. Which, because all of their stuff just kind of vaguely has a peanutty, peanut buttery scent to it. I'm not really getting a ton of that on the nose here. I am getting a lot of brown sugar, some caramel, some vanilla. The alcohol is definitely present, but it's not overwhelming, which is really good. But I'm wondering when this peanut butter is going to show up. It still makes for a really good nose, and I think I'll also give it an 8 out of 10.
You know what, Bob? As I take a few more passes at the nose, I think I am getting a little bit of that peanut butter. Maybe not even peanut butter, but just a little bit of nuttiness to it that it's interesting, man. I'm really excited to give it a taste.
Brad, I thought that you were moving into the taste portion, and so you go ahead and give it a taste. This is incredible. It is like maybe the sweetest bourbon I've ever had in my life. This is like overwhelmingly sweet. And it is just like a punch of caramel and brown sugar. It doesn't quite taste like banana, but it has that almost like bananas level of concentrated sugariness to it. And then like right when I go to swallow, it doesn't sour, but it almost gets like this really great layer of fresh squeezed orange juice about it too. Like there's a little bit of citrus there. And then when you swallow, it's like, there's the 125 proof. This, Brad, this is one of the best bourbons I think I've ever tasted. I'm just going to be honest here. And I've seen people online saying this is one of their least favorite batches of Booker's. And I'm fine with that because some people don't like things that are like bordering on oversweet, but I do when it comes to bourbon. I'm going to give this a 10 out of 10 on the taste, Brad.
Wow. Bob, that is, you don't often give 10s out of 10s. Neither of us do.
No.
I think I'm pretty close there with you. This is a spectacular bourbon. I think for me, you get a few more of those nutty notes on the palate. That oakiness comes through. There's a lot of caramel. There's a little bit of spiciness, but nothing that's going to overpower you. It's a very complex palate that I'm going to give it a 9.5.
Yeah, it's like I just took another sip. It's almost Coca-Cola-y for a hot second there, but overwhelmingly caramel. Like it is just a ton of, however you want to say it, caramel on the palate. When you kick it to the back of your mouth and you go to start swallowing, that's where the oak shows up. It's not an overpowering level of oak. It's not competing with the sweet flavors. It's just nicely complementing them. You swallow and you get a little bit of a Kentucky hug, but not a tremendous one. And the great thing is the alcohol doesn't make itself known on your tongue until after you swallow. And then it was like all of my tongue experienced the alcohol at the same time, like from the tip of my tongue to the back of my tongue. It's this layer of heat after you swallow and this kind of great prickly feeling. And it's this wonderful transition from each thing to the next. Brad, I'm having a euphoric moment over here. Like it's like a symphony in my mouth. I'm such a big fan of this.
When I get onto the finish, you almost get a little bit of that toasted peanut. And for the first time, I think really in my whiskey journey, I can actually really strongly say that I taste a little bit of that leather taste that people talk about. Mm-hmm. And I am just so, so impressed. I'm going to give it a 9.5 on the finish, and partially for the fact that the burn on this is strong, but pleasant.
Yeah.
It's one of the best barrel proof finishes I've ever had.
Yeah. Brad, I 100% agree with that leathery note. You know, it's not like we chew on leather, but it has that sensation on the palate that you get when you smell leather. For me, it's that combination of that, but it's also like this really bitter orange peel. I am getting just a slight note of citrus as well. I really, really like that a lot. And moving into the finish, there, like I said, there is a Kentucky hug. There's a little bit of a warming sensation when it goes down. It's not overpowering. And, you know, the tingle that you get on your tongue is different from the alcohol burn in your chest on the way down. And they're both like the best of both worlds. I'm also going to give this a 9.5 on the finish. I am in love with this whiskey, Brad. And that brings us to overall balance. This is where we talk about nose, taste, and finish all put together. Brad, I will say that now that I've had a couple sips and I'm going back and I'm nosing it again, I'm starting to get a little bit of that peanut butter. I don't really taste the nuttiness on the flavor or the finish here. And so, like, I don't need that note to be present all the way throughout. I am kind of bummed that there wasn't any peanut butteriness for me. But that doesn't really take away from how I think this is balanced. I think this is a superbly balanced whiskey. The nose is probably the weakest part of it for me, and I think I'll give it an 8.5 on balance.
Bob, I think I'm going to give it a 9 on balance. And moving from the nose to the palate to the finish, there is a lot of complexity in each avenue, but they all complement each other so well that, like, this is the definition of balance that I'm looking for in a whiskey.
Mm. So that takes us to the price. And again, you may not even find this particular batch of Booker's on the shelf anymore. Again, it's over a year old now. I have it on good authority, though, that they all try to stay within that general Jim Beam flavor profile. You're not going to get wildly varying flavor profiles from batch to batch with Booker's. So we're scoring this, you know, not just that we're judging this one batch of Booker's, but overall, how do we feel about the brand of Booker's? And based on this, Brad, I'm going to give it a very high score. But in the state of Ohio, a bottle of Booker's is going to set you back $84.99. It is a top shelf bourbon. It's a high end bourbon. I'm going to just be honest here, Brad, and say this might be one of my top three or four favorite barrel proof bourbons we've ever had on this show. And I absolutely think that it is worth $84.99. If you're going to drop money on a bourbon and you know that you're going to be asked to spend $85, it better knock your socks off. And this one did. And this is one of the few times that I can say that the price tag is justified for what you're getting in the glass.
Yeah, this is a whiskey that is worth paying $85 for. If you're able to find a dram of it at a, you know, a whiskey bar near you, awesome. Go get some. But if you're going to spend money on a whole bottle, I think it's well worth it. I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10 on value.
There's a part of me that wants to give it a 7.5 on value, just because I don't agree with paying this much for bourbon in general. But again, it's very small batch. It's almost like a vintage with wine. You're never going to get a batch just like this again. And so, Brad, I think I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10 on the value, even at $85. And that is bringing me out to a 45 out of 50. This is far and away my highest scored whiskey of the season and one of the best whiskeys I have ever, ever had on this show.
Bob, I am right there with you at a 45 out of 50.
Wow.
This is one of the tastiest whiskeys I've ever had. And I only had a few sips of it. And I am probably the most satisfied I've ever been drinking a whiskey on this podcast.
Yeah. There have only ever been now two whiskeys that have hit the 90 mark. We had the Glenmorangie Quinta Rubin 14 year and this. And Brad, as much as I love that Quinta Rubin 14, I think this might be the whiskey that I would prefer. It's barrel proof. It packs a punch. It absolutely earns its price tag. Not that the Quinta Rubin doesn't, but this is a special occasion bourbon that I will look forward to sharing with people, you know, when I inevitably go out and buy another bottle of it.
Well, guys, there you have it. This Booker's is highly recommended by both of us. It's a spectacular whiskey. It's near the top of our list. I suppose the only question at this point, Bob, is will Psycho also finish near the top of our movie list for the Film and Whiskey podcast?
Well, Brad, let's find out and get back to talking about it. All right, everybody. So that was Booker's, for those of you who care, batch 2019-01, Teresa's batch. That was freaking phenomenal. I am still reeling from the experience. Brad, I almost don't even want to get back into talking about Psycho, but the thing is, I love this movie. I just don't know how it's going to compare to that whiskey. That was so good.
Well, it's a spectacular whiskey paired with a spectacular movie. And we kind of talked already about, you know, the various tropes that this movie kind of established. Now, one of my favorite tropes from this movie, I'm not sure if Psycho established it or not, but I have always noticed, and this spans television or film or video games, any medium in which you can tell a story. If somebody that is a main character makes a promise to somebody else, whether it's to meet them somewhere or, you know, I'll find you when this is over, you know, any sort of thing like that, they gonna die.
It's over
like,
for them.
Like, guaranteed over for them.
So wait, are you talking about when Janet Leigh told Norman that she was going to go back to Phoenix or
no, what? I think specifically it to be a part of the trope. Maybe I'm making up my own trope here. But to be a part of the trope, you have to actually use the words, something along the lines of like, I'll call you soon, I promise. Like, you have to use the words I promise in some way. The private investigator, Arbogast, promises Lila that he will phone again soon. And as soon as he did I was like, oh,
he's a
goner. And I don't know if Hitchcock started that trope, but there's a part of me that really wants to hope that he did in this movie.
That's really funny, man. I never even thought about that. This might be like the origin of that happening when someone's,
yeah.
You know, they talk about it in that movie Scream, from the 90s, they go over all the rules of horror movies. And one of the rules is, whenever somebody says, I'll be right back, they never come back again. This might be the first I'll be right back.
Yeah, it really might have been.
And I feel like this movie was the first for a lot of things, Brad. And we talked about some of them in the first half. But I think this movie really set the golden standard for horror movie scoring. And you have it come up again in 15 years after this when John Williams does the score for Jaws. But Bernard Herrmann's score for this movie is lights out great. Like, it is, it's an iconic score. And it's such a bold move for him to only use strings. Like, instead of using the full orchestra, he only uses strings. And, you know, you have that really great staccato whenever somebody's getting stabbed. And it's just such a brilliant touch, because even when you're not getting that classic, you know, murder music, you get the suspenseful building themes that he does throughout the film, but they're still all done with strings. It's a really cool score, and I think it's 100% effective for what's going on screen.
I really just want the rest of this episode to be you imitating the strings from this movie. No, Bob, you're 100% right. When I heard the score when she was in the shower, it instantly was like, oh, this is, quote, the horror theme, end quote. You know what I mean? And I was like, oh, this is where it comes from. And it was another moment of kind of like little like cinema delight for me. Like, I almost giggled. I was like, oh, yeah, I figured out where that came from now. Good job, Brad. Because like you see so many different tropes in movies. It's just refreshing to see whether it is a musical trope or a cinematographer or, you know, whatever it is. It's just nice to see them in their original habitat.
Absolutely.
Like to see them where they were intended to be. And it does kind of make you wonder, like, there's a reason that worked, but how often do movies not need to lean into something that's already established and, like, push the boundary into something new?
Mm-hmm. Well, and another thing, Brad, that I think this might be the gold standard for is a term that Hitchcock used a lot that has been brought, you know, if you've studied movies at all, you've heard the word before, and that is MacGuffin. This movie might be the epitome of the MacGuffin. And Hitchcock used this word because it was nonsensical, but he used it to talk about something that basically drives the plot forward. It is something that's like necessary to the characters in the movie, to the plot being set in motion, but that ultimately doesn't matter at all. It ends up having no bearing on what actually happens in the movie. And I think a lot of people confuse the term MacGuffin with just like a plot device. It's not the same thing as a plot device. Like, yes, it often sets the plot in motion, but it ends up being something completely irrelevant. And in this movie, it's the $40,000. Like, for the first 45 minutes of this movie, you are following Janet Leigh as she's trying to steal money from her boss and run off and join her boyfriend, Sam. And you're with her when she's nervous, when she's being followed by police, like when she's trying to buy a new car. You think that this $40,000 is going to be the driving force of the whole movie. And then after Marion gets killed, the camera, like, you know, pans over and shows the money just sitting on the nightstand. And when Norman cleans up the body, he just tosses it in the trunk and dumps it in the swamp. And you find out that the $40,000 didn't matter at all. And I think it's a really, really cool thing that Hitchcock does with the MacGuffin in this movie, because, like, yeah, it gets us to the Bates Motel, but it's almost like a bait and switch, because we think the movie is going to be about that money, and the money has absolutely no bearing on what happens for the rest of the film.
Well, I think one of the beautiful things about this movie being in black and white is that it's reminiscent of another genre that I would almost say that this movie falls into, which would be film noir. Because when you really think about this movie, it starts off in a lot of ways like a movie we did a little while back, you know, Double Indemnity, that this movie is about secret lovers who are trying to score a big payday so that they can be together. And there's a private investigator. And, you know, even at the end of the movie, when you realize it's not a film noir, it's more of a thriller horror film, even at the end, they still fall into the film noir category of having somebody explain kind of what happened.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's a lot of things in this movie that make the MacGuffin of the $40,000 feel like it's going to be the impetus of the movie. And once again, Hitchcock is gives a masterclass on, like you said, Bob, a bait and switch by saying, no, it's actually about this guy who has had a psychological break and thinks he's his mother and murders people.
You know, Brad, like while we're making comparisons here, a few weeks ago, I found out my wife had never seen the movie Jaws. And I was like, you know what? It's been such a long time since I've seen Jaws. Let's watch it. We have HBO Max. And so I turned it on and it's terrifying. It's always been terrifying. But I guess I had never noticed how influenced by Psycho Spielberg was when he made his horror masterpiece, Jaws. And I noticed it especially like in the structure of the two movies, because Jaws is kind of just like this. Like it's split in halves where the first half of the movie, you've got this like faceless, nameless killing machine that's just indiscriminately killing people. Every now and then it pops up and eats somebody and it's horrifying. And then halfway through the movie, they're like, well, I guess we should try to go out into the bay and kill this thing. And it turns into like this rousing sea adventure movie. It's a complete 180. And for me, like I love Jaws, but the weirdest thing for me is trying to grapple with the fact that it goes from like, you know, a monster movie to an adventure movie halfway through. And I think that if I am being honest, Brad, my minor quibble with this movie is that it goes from being a suspense film where you're like on the lam with Janet Leigh to a psychological horror film halfway through. And Hitchcock pulls the rug out from under you with so little notice that it takes a while to kind of get your bearings. And then he does it again at the end of the film when you find out that it's not the mother, but it's Anthony Perkins that's killing people. And it's such a weird, jarring shift that you have to have this psychologist character come in and explain what the heck's going on. You know, I feel like I needed that. And I'm watching this in 2020 with 60 years of copycat movies in between. I can't imagine how confused some of the viewers of this movie must have been in 1960. Like that last 10 minutes where the psychologist is just giving a monologue, it's super boring. But it's also like really necessary, because otherwise I think it would have been a really head-scratching way to end the movie.
See, I actually disagree with you there, Bob. I personally think that the psychologist was overkill at the end.
Oh, I agree. But I think part of that is because it's easier for us to understand what was going on 60 years later, because we've seen 60 years of movies like this. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think America had ever seen a movie with a twist ending, you know, featuring a guy who had embalmed his own mother and was like assuming her personality. Like, people probably didn't even know about dissociative identity disorder back in the 60s. Like, it had to be the first time people were even hearing about stuff like this.
Oh, I'm sure that it was. But there's a part of me that wonders if he had just left it as is, mm-hmm. and just not explained it. And you just kind of wonder, would this have been considered even more of a masterpiece,
yeah,
that he was willing to make the audience sit with the question of what happened?
Yep.
You know, that's something that, you know, is a Christopher Nolan type of thing. Like, oh, you know, what happened? Does the top stop spinning? I don't know. But like, I feel like that would have been extremely effective if it had been done in this movie. But you are probably right. America was not ready for that level of a cliffhanger.
No, for sure. But you're also right in that it grinds the movie to a screeching halt right when you want it to be like a sucker punch of an ending. I do think that they were smart enough to go back to Norman at the very end of the movie after he's been completely consumed by this mother figure. And like, to end on that note was very chilling and I think the right call. But that psychologist stuff was definitely like overlong, overkill. And it ruined any momentum the movie had to that point. And Brad, I think that like that pretty much takes us to our final scores here. I'm really interested to hear what you have to say about this movie. I can kind of tell that you may not think it's as perfect as some of the other Hitchcock movies we watched, but what kind of a score would you give this, Brad?
Bob, this is a phenomenal movie that has so many different things going for it. But the tropes are so well established that for me as a viewer in 2020, there are certain elements of the movie that I just wasn't quite as drawn in by. And I think that his other films, I think that when you get into North by Northwest and Vertigo and some of his other movies, I just enjoy the characters a lot more in those films. And, you know, you have a little more time to spend with them. You see them in different locations. So this, while I would definitely say this is just another example of Hitchcock being a master director, like one of the greatest legends ever to, you know, sit behind the camera, I'm going to give it a 9.5 out of 10. Mm-hmm. I think it's great. I think it's spectacular. There's a few tacky parts of the movie that I really struggled with, primarily being when you see the private eye falling down the stairs, like little things like that.
With just a big gash in his head.
Yeah, there's the big gash in his head. Just little things like that. That was the few times where you could tell that the budget might not have been high enough. But even I look at Vertigo and, you know, when Jimmy Stewart is sees himself falling down, you know, from the great height, like those special effects weren't very good either. So I kind of get it. For the times, the special effects couldn't be what I might want them to be. But in the end, it's a great movie, Bob.
Yeah, I'm right there, Brad. I think if I'm being honest, like, I only enjoyed this movie a 9 out of 10 level, but I have to kind of put myself in my own historical context where, like you said, the tropes are so well established now that it takes away from the shock that this movie must have been in 1960. And I can't really fault the movie for the fact that it is so influential. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not the movie's fault that it was so well done that everyone copied it for 60 years. And so I think that does bump it up for me to a 9.5 out of 10. It's definitely not perfect. Like we said, it grinds to a halt at the end of the movie. I think that the fact that the last two characters left in the film are Vera Miles and John Gavin, who are probably the two worst actors in the movie also. Like, it made it a little harder to watch after a while. And then for me, there's the fact that, like, I can't really grasp what the moral of the story is here. Like, it's either that, you know, in some sick way that Janet Leigh deserved to be punished for what she did, which is really, I don't like thinking about that. Or the moral of the story is that there is no moral, and it's a very cynical, nihilistic movie, which I also don't like. And I think the fact that I don't have any sort of anything to grasp onto from this film, a lasting lesson, is kind of unsettling. And that might be the point, but it also kind of takes the film down a peg in my estimation. So, you know what? I am also going to give this a 9.5 out of 10. It's a great movie. It's a landmark film. It absolutely deserves to be right up there with Hitchcock's best. But for me, it's just slightly below Vertigo and Rear Window.
Well, I think, just to comment really quickly, I think it felt kind of like The Birds. You know what I mean? Where, like, you get to the end of The Birds and it's like, yeah, some birds just attacked a town.
And that's it.
And that's it. And like, and that this movie felt a lot like that for me. But in the end, the important thing isn't what Bob and I have to say about this movie. It's what you, Film and Whiskey Nation, have to say about the film. Find us on our Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter pages at Film Whiskey.
Or you can give us a phone call. Our number is 216-800-5923. That's 216-800-5923. Or you could leave us a voicemail on our anchor.fm webpage.
Next week, we will be looking at one of Bob and I's favorite Pixar films, 2017's Coco.
So join us next week for that. For the Film and Whiskey Podcast, I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And we'll see you next time.